House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, February 8th, 2012. We're going to go out of order today. The first item on the agenda is going to be House Bill 4095. We expect to have a brief hearing and then move it today, or at least vote on it, have a work session. We had testimony the other day, and a lot of people testified. Today we're going to have, I'd like you to talk about the Dash 4 amendments if you could. The one thing I don't want is some of the people the other day were characterizing what their opposition thought or meant or whatever, and there was some pretty inflammatory language about some of the other side's lying about this. I don't want to hear any of that today. I don't want to hear what the other side is going to do. If you just tell us why you think your position is a good position, why the bill is good or not, but without any personal attacks. And we need to have your testimony brief, because we have a lot to do and not much time. So with that being said, I'll call up Mickey Killingsworth, Jonathan Manton. I'm sorry. And Representative Girard, please. And Espinal. So if I could have them first. I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't see it.
I understand why you couldn't see Representative Girard, but you should have seen me.
I was as high as I could go, Mr. Co-Chair. I am State Rep. Phil Girard, District 56. Members of the committee, let me briefly explain the Dash 4 amendment. I am assuming, Mr. Co-Chair, that the testimony this morning will only be in relationship to the Dash 4s. Is that correct?
We may have it a little bit farther than that, okay, because it was scheduled for a hearing.
As I mentioned during my testimony on Monday morning, House Bill 4095 is essentially a redraft of House Bill 3615 from the 2011 session. However, this amendment makes several changes, which are in response to a request from the governor's natural resources advisor, Richard Whitman. During a recent meeting that I had with Mr. Whitman, he asked that the Department of Land Conservation and Development not have to take action on any petitions that are filed by the counties until the start of the 2013-15 biennium. In response to that request, the Dash 4 amendment requires the agency to act on any petitions beginning on July 1st, 2013. This change is contained in Section 8 of the amendment. And to continue our explanation of the Dash 4s, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you. Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. Because no action would be taken on the petitions until the next biennium, the bill also takes the $350,000 that is appropriated as grant money for the counties and the $250,000 that is appropriated for the to cover agency expenses and delays spending it until July 1st, 2013. The amendment puts the money into a separate and distinct account. The money will be deposited in the account on June 30th, 2013, and the money will be, with the exception of $1, cannot be spent until 2013-2015 biennium. The changes can be found in sections 5, 6, and 7 of the amendment. This amendment makes some minor, non-substantive changes. I ask that you adopt it into 4095 and pass the bill on to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendations. And we're available for questions.
Any questions? Representative Garrett.
Thank you both. Just to be clear, this looks like it is a complete rewrite of the bill. Thank you.
Yes, you're correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
if we're looking at a complete rewrite of the bill, can we have a summary of what the bill does?
Yes, as Mr. Taylor gets back.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I heard you earlier direct testimony to be only about the amendment, which we only got 10 minutes ago. People who traveled hundreds of miles to testify have only seen it this morning. It's pretty challenging for them to have useful testimony to offer on an amendment that they haven't seen until just now.
Mr. Chair, we're doing health care reform, education reform. We are flying like a bat out of hell around here. And to suggest that we're going too fast on this may be true. But everything else is going too fast, too, except for job creation bills. Now, I share my colleague's concern that this is not the only situation that this is happening.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendment does replace the bill, but it is substantially similar to the old bill, the one before it. What the amendment does is to set forth in the staff measure summary under the effect of the amendments allows Jackson, Josephine, or Douglas County to enter into an intergovernmental agreement between at least two of the counties in order to petition Land and Conservation Development Commission to establish by rule definitions of the term of agricultural land and forest land for land use planning in the counties and allows the counties involved to apply to the Department of Land Conservation Development for funds necessary to establish by rule these definitions. And then it creates the Regional Resource Land Program Fund, appropriates $600,000, of which $300,000, I think, goes to the county, $250,000 goes to the agency for the purposes of developing these rules, which I believe have to be approved by the Land Commission. But I have to admit, this is an area I don't normally deal in, and I think Representative Girard could probably better explain the subtle differences between the two bills. I don't think they're major.
Mr. Chair, could we get the LC drafter to come explain the bill to us? These are. I appreciate Mr. Taylor's suggestion that they're similar to the original bill, but this is a pretty profound change in state law, and I think it's important for us to understand if we're going to pass any judgment on it. We should at least know what the bill does. Whether we agree with it or not, everyone who votes on it should know what it does. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Then what we're going to do is suspend the hearing for the time being while we have somebody come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Temporary close the hearing on House Bill 4095. I'll just go ahead and open that one real quick. You guys are trying to park the money. Can you just insert the dash for us?
Yeah, I'll have it.
Which one are we talking about? We're talking to everybody. Whichever one we're going to do. 2022. Okay.
So we have an amendment. Yeah, that's the one the judge agreed to. Tell us what the amendment is. We have to rescind the dash twos and threes, right?
No, that's a different bill. Open a work session on House Bill 4023. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4023 creates a community guardianship provision and defines the term of child caring agency license under ORS 418205 to 418-30. Allows the court to appoint a community guardian if a juvenile has spent more than 3 years in substitute care. Proposed community guardianship provided care services to the juvenile immediate 12 months. There is no other appropriate permanency plan. For the ward, the proposed guardianship would include planning and guidance for the juvenile's successful transition to independent living. Mr. Chairman, as a committee, you have the dash four amendments in front of you, and basically they shift the, actually it's a dash, the dash three. They shift the guardianship provisions from the permanent guardianship, where it would be, the process would be somewhat involve termination of parental rights from RS-419B-365 to RS-419B-366. I meant to say the dash three amendment. And that would make the process a lot less cumbersome and wouldn't require the detailed process of terminating parental rights. Also, the other issue that was involved in the dash four amendments was
Bill, can you speak up a little
Marion
bit?
Polk and the
I don't think anybody can hear.
Okay. I'm sorry. You have the dash three amendments in front of you?
And the dash four.
And before.
Discussion?
I'm having trouble. I'm sorry. So this is limited to one county?
Chairman of the committee, there are two sets of amendments. The dash three would make it applicable to the whole state, okay? And the main thing that it does is it switches from 419B 365 to 419B 366. The process and procedure around 366 is a lot less cumbersome than 419B 365. You don't have to terminate the parental rights here, okay? It has considerable more flexibility. And in considerably less cost. You may remember Jim Seymour testified, and the Chief Justice testified on behalf of this bill. And it's a way of helping kids that don't have good parents transition into society better.
So if I may, Mr. Chair, so that was dash three. We have a dash four that is just for the three counties. Are we looking at that amendment also?
It's on the, it's here, but I don't know that we want to move that. I'm not in favor of that amendment. Yes.
Mr. Co-Chair, I just want to acknowledge that I very much appreciate Mr. Seymour and Chief Justice DeMunez's work with us on addressing this concern and their willingness to accommodate the changes that we suggested.
Thank you.
So I'll support the dash threes.
Thank you, Representative. Hey, we're in work session.
Well, I talked with Judge Waller afterwards, and my understanding was that it was her intent to change it to just three counties as a pilot project, and I would definitely be in support of that. As I said before, I was really concerned about the unintended consequences of this, especially if it's all around the state. All the testimony we heard of was from Catholic Family Services, and I have a great deal of respect for them. But when we're opening up throughout the state, I have some concerns.
Mr. Chair, we have qualified entities, nonprofits, people that are doing that. In fact, I found out we actually got one in Curry County of all places. It's small, but there is one there. It would have to meet some standards and, you know, to qualify, but to limit it to this after we've got a couple pretty good judges that took a look at this and staff over in the justice system. And some of the, well, I guess, concerns, I think were pretty much refuted in the letter from Livingston. I don't know if you've read all that or not, but I'm confident that this isn't going to cause a problem. Our lack of direction in this field since I've been here, I think has put more kids in jeopardy at the hands of Department of Human Resources than maybe at the hands of some of the parents and people that are so-called abusers. Those of us that have taken a look at the sensitive review committees have seen some pretty horrendous things that nobody in the room knows unless you've been on the committee. And I think it's time for us to make an opportunity for especially this age group. These are not little children anymore. They're 16 years old. They're 2 years from being an adult. And I think it's a great opportunity to give them more opportunity.
Thank you. Open to a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash three amendments into House Bill 4023.
Representative Krieger moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 4023. Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 4095 as of 4023.
That it be passed and sent down to the Control of Ways and Means. Representative Krieger moves House Bill 4023 with the dash 3 amendment to Ways and Means be passed. Is there any discussion?
Sure.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. It's kind of a comment on all of this today. Everything's going to Ways and Means. Because it may have fiscal impact. In Washington, the substantive committee is also the Ways and Means Subcommittee. I think what's going on here this session is clearly there's only one committee that's going to make any decisions around here, and it ain't us. We're irrelevant. And I just think it's wrong, and I don't like it, and I agree we are going too fast on too many very substantive subjects. But for everything to go through one committee is wrong. There's 60 representatives. We should all have a say in what's going on. And I'm just kind of disappointed in that whole thing, just because it may have a fiscal impact statement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion? There's a motion to move 4023 with the dash 3s to Ways and Means. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nola?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Excuse.
Representative
Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative May?
No, and I guess I just want to speak to that. I may vote yes on the floor. I want to get this in my clock.
Thank you.
Representative Wan?
Aye.
Representative Wisman?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Okay, we'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 4095. Mr. Conley. There, the question came up about the bill, if it's the amendment's being described as a rewrite. And so if you could please explain to us. If you could explain to us what the difference is, and if you would identify yourself before you speak for the record, please.
Harrison Conley, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Good to see you this morning, members. The dash four, I believe essentially what we do with the dash four is the concern to a significant extent how this is different from the bill we had last session. Is that my understanding?
Well, no, how different it is from the current bill, because we were being told it's a complete rewrite. We just received the amendment.
Okay.
And so there's questions of people, what does this do? Because it is such a substantial change of the law.
Okay. I think the way this restructures the process is that I believe in the dash four, we no longer have an emergency clause, so we have made the bill effective January 1, 2013. All sections but Section 3 will become operative at that time. Section 3 does not become operative until the new biennium, July 1, 2013. So what that allows us to do in this draft is it allows the three counties, or at least two of the three, to enter into an intergovernmental agreement to petition the Land Conservation and Development Commission for the administrative rules to allow regional definitions of resource lands, and it allows the counties to make the request for the grant funds in this biennium. The bill in the dash four version would appropriate monies for the purpose in this biennium, would place those monies in a continuously appropriated fund, but directs the treasurer to make the deposit on the last day of the biennium, June 30th, 2013. There is a $1 expenditure limit in the bill now. At present, the portion of the bill that becomes operative in January would also allow the commission to distribute the grant funds. However, the bill at present has only a $1 expenditure limit, so they would need an expenditure limit to do that. So essentially, the money is not available to the commission until the last day of the biennium, which also likely will mean that you would have to give them an expenditure limit in the next biennium to spend the remainder of the appropriation.
Questions? Any discussion? Representative Westnett, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Connolly, I was asked by my county commissioners today, they're writing a letter of support for this bill, and I know that it looks like Representative Garrard has left, but I want to put it in the record that there is discussion. I think the supporters of this bill are looking at this as successful, but they will look at other counties to do the same in a regional type land use. They discuss that with you, and you know anything about that.
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I have heard this described as a pilot project. I have not heard any discussion about possible extension.
Okay. Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you for those comments. And the committee, I would then like to put in the record that I think there has been discussion, and we've talked about regional land use, and with these controls that is on this, that we should consider this. I hope that this is successful and people will be happy and confident that we're still protecting land in Oregon and how the policy will proceed to regionalize in other counties. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Connolly, what I've heard you talking about, the difference between the two bills of implementation dates and funding. So I take it there is no substantial policy differences between the original bill and the Dash 4 amendments?
Co-chairs, Mr. Taylor, I believe that is correct. We have done some rearranging of the deck chairs, especially because of the operative dates and sort of trying to put we've rearranged the pieces so that essentially I think what we've done is we've pushed off agency action to the next biennium.
But thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Connolly, Section 2, Paragraph 2 reads, if at least two of the three counties enter an intergovernmental agreement described in subsection 1 of this section, the counties that are parties to the agreement jointly may petition the Land Conservation and Development Commission to establish by rule a definition of the term agricultural land and the definition of the term forest land, or both, et cetera, et cetera. My reading of that is that ultimately the state-level Department of Land Conservation and Development, the state-level Land Conservation and Development Commission, will have final say in what this definition is going to be. Is that an accurate reading?
Co-chairs, Co-Vice Chair Hicks, first, I believe did you read from the bill as opposed to the Dash 4 version?
Oh,
because
you know
I was trying to follow along.
Yeah, I held the wrong.
The answer, I think, is that there's slight wording difference, but that is still going to be the substantive
okay.
result.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, your question?
Yeah, is the state still?
Yes. They would have to adopt goals by rules, and they would have to adopt the regional definitions by rule, and the bill does provide discretion so that they could choose to deny, I don't guess they could deny a petition, but there is a possibility that no rulemaking would result.
So, one more, just in other words, the state may either approve or disapprove the petition.
I believe that they have to accept the petition and consider the issues, but there is no mandate that rulemaking is a result.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Kind of relating to what I said earlier, I thank you for coming and explaining the substance of that bill. It's a substantive committee. That's what we do here. I'm fairly confident this and other bills will go to Ways and Means, and they will not look at the revenue and fiscal impact. They will be more concerned about the substance of the language, and it'll live or die based on their decision. And since they do that there, I think we should, and I'm not suggesting we do this, Ms. Chair, because I know we don't have the time. Notice of no revenue impact. This is not true. It's inaccurate. There's going to be a very positive revenue impact when and if this policy comes to be, because the people who live in these communities will have control of their own future, unlike today. Mr. Chair, I'm extremely frustrated, as you can tell, but this revenue statement is wrong. It's inaccurate. And everyone in here, with a thimble full of common sense, would agree with me.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I think I'm asking you to recap a little bit, Harrison, but under this amendment, what's the earliest date that any action can be taken to affect any kind of change under this bill if we enact it?
Co-chairs, co-vice chair Garrett, in the dash four, we have taken off the emergency clause. Without an emergency clause, 91 days is the earliest effective date that we could have provided. With our silence, the date is automatically January 1 of 2013. So that is the earliest date that any of the provisions become operative with the dash four.
Follow up. I meant with respect to the appropriation of money. That's not going to happen until the next biennium, is that right?
Well, again, the appropriation is for the 2011-2013 biennium, for the current biennium. The appropriation is placed into a new fund outside the general fund and continuously appropriated to the agency. But the bill also contains an expenditure limit of $1 so that at the very least, the body would have to take additional action to spend more money in this biennium or the next. But the functions in terms of the substantive portions of the bill that become operative before July 1, the actions are all on the counties except for the ability of the commission to respond to their request for grants. So it's entirely possible that on the last day of the biennium, the money would be deposited in the account and they would already have a request for the grant funds, the $350,000 from the counties, in hand. Now, they would only be able to spend more than the dollar of it if the E-Board grants them the expenditure limit.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming up with a very short notice. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, we'll have testimony again. We need to for people to keep it really short. I'll start again. Mickey Killingsworth, Jonathan Manton, and Aileen K. Aileen K.
Action on their own. Now.
Again, please, I really need to be brief.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and Krieger. I'm Mickey Killingsworth from Jefferson County in the state of Oregon, not in the state of Jefferson. And those of you from Southern Oregon will truly know what that means. It's an old saying. Because the three counties involved in here for years have wanted to succeed, especially Jackson and Josephine counties.
We need you to stay on topic here.
Well, that's at the heart of this bill. The heart of this bill is you're going to allow a pilot program. And after listening to legal counsel, Mr. Harrison, talk through the math, my testimony that I submitted probably doesn't really apply like it did before. I'm really concerned. I'm a taxpayer. I'm a farmer. I'm a shepherd. And I'm sitting here listening to the math, and I don't do business that way. You're the state of Oregon. You're broke. You're probably broker than I am. Actually, if we looked at what all you have to do, you guys are making some pretty tough decisions in this short session, like Representative Schaffler said. Important decision. There are means already to do this type of mapping in those statutes now. You passed a bill in 09. I think it was House Bill 22-something. I'm not an expert on this. I'm a farmer. But I'm testifying for myself and Jefferson County Farm Bureau to save in time. So I'm going to read Jefferson County Farm Bureau's testimony in real quick. Jefferson County Farm Bureau has a saying on their letterhead that says, agriculture is the basic industry for life. Our Farm Bureau truly believes in this bill will undermine the stability of agriculture when a region can change the definition even in a limited private program. On page 29 of the Oregon Farm Bureau policy book, Section 3015, lines 8 through 15. Oregon Farm Bureau does not support redefining agriculture land and forest lands by counties based on factors other than the statewide criteria identified in Goal 3 and Goal 4. While different regions of the state may have varying levels of non-farm development pressures, a standard definition of agricultural land and forest lands under Goal 3 and 4 is key to maintaining the agricultural land base and to minimizing conflicts from non-farm uses. Local governments should be encouraged to use the land evaluation system and site assessment system developed by the Soil Conservation Society as a tool to determine relative value of parcels of land to agriculture use. Profitability should not be considered for the purposes of defining agriculture land subject to the goal. That's the heart of Jefferson County Farm Bureau's testimony. I won't go on. You have it in record. Agriculture provides 1 in 8 jobs. It is important to keep agriculture in whole. And I live in Central Oregon in Jefferson County, which is north of Representative Wizard's district. And our county treasures are 58,000 acres, and we'll fight as hard as we can to never land a pilot project involve our ag ground there for a different definition of agriculture.
Okay, thank you. Jonathan?
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here on behalf of Central Oregon Land Watch and also myself personally. I want to just quickly thank staff. Like, one of the impacts of that I think a lot of us lose sight on, I'm moving so quick as we're doing. I got the dash force last night just, you know, through being in the building a lot. But staff has to deal with all of us making requests for these amendments and trying to look at them so fast. So I just wanted to take a second to say thanks to Enola and the staff for, trying to work with this kind of situation. This is kind of crazy to do things so fast, as has been pointed out. So I was able to catch up with Paul Dewey, who's a land use attorney for over 30 years in the state in Central Oregon last night, and he was able to, during the middle of the night, look at some of these amendments, and I submitted some supplemental testimony that I hope you'll take a look at with regard to just the dash fours that you may want to get today or at some point. But the point that I wanted to make with my time right now is that, you know, we're not really looking at the impact of redefining ag and forest lands on Goal 5, which is protection of natural resources. Some of those natural resources are groundwater, winter range habitat for deer and elk. And by the way, we haven't done an inventory of these ground Goal 5 resources in over 30 years. So we're talking about kind of redefining soil, we're talking about kind of redefining forest lands, but we haven't looked at what the impacts of this is going to be. You know, perhaps there should be some funding set aside for re-inventorying the Goal 5 resources as well. And I have a great deal of respect for the members of this committee. I've had a chance to work with a lot of you on a number of different issues, and so I just very quickly want to share my personal reason for why I work for Land Watch and why I'm involved in this issue. I grew up in a very small town in rural North Georgia, and I had lots of friends who were farmers. I used to go get my hair cut at a barbershop where we would talk about turkey hunting, we talk about deer hunting, and we talk about catching trout in the streams. If you go back to that piece of land now in that part of Georgia, there is no more hunting. There is no more, talk of catching, playing in the creek with kids, because they don't have protections for ag and forest land there. And when I go back and visit, it looks totally different now. It's strip malls and subdivisions. The city of Atlanta has just completely swallowed that area. It's not rural. It's not a sense of community anymore. And when you go back to visit and talk to the people that were there all along, back when I was a kid, they said, there's no way the ag land is going to get consumed. We have so much of it. It's everywhere. Like, there was never a thought that, that the resource land that's there was going to be jeopardized. And they will tell you, and these are not by any means liberal folks. You know, these are people that, are very hardcore conservative in their political leanings. And they will tell you, my gosh, I wish we could still have our way of life that we had back then. And they tell it to me every time I go home. It's the first thing people say. It's like, oh, you haven't been here in a while. So, all these changes are nuts, aren't they? We sit in traffic all the time. You know, we don't have the ag lands that we wish we had, and we don't have the sense of community that we had at that time. So I just ask you to kind of consider that. I hope you will just keep that in mind as you vote on this and not take for granted that, the impact of ag land on community and what can happen. And that's just the experience that I've had, growing up in Georgia. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Aileen Kay, Marion County.
Ms. Kay, you testified the other day, so please.
Will be very brief. This is because of the amendments.
Thank you.
I'm requesting that you do not move this bill out of committee. I agree with Mr. Schaffler, Representative Schaffler. This whole thing is just going too fast. If people still want this legislation, it would be much more appropriate to bring it back in the 2013 session. It's a major, major change to our land use laws. Agriculture is the second largest industry we have in Oregon. The thing I don't agree with Mr. Schaffler on is that it will help our economy. I think it will harm our economy. In Texas, there's severe drought. People are going to start relying more on Oregon for agricultural commodities. So I hope that you will not move on this. It's much more appropriate for the long session, not this little short session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, panel.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We've had this bill before, so I believe, for a concept very similar for three sessions. Now they want to put it off to 2013, and they'll have the same excuses in 2013 that they're saying today, and I'm getting tired of it. I agree with Representative Schaffer. No state has adopted Oregon's land use system because it's a damn poor system that takes property rights away. Half the people that talk are never going to be the ones have talked are never going to be in the county where it's going to be implemented. It's a pilot project. And then you say Farm Bureau, State Farm Bureau is against it. Go talk to your local farmers. You'll find out the majority of them aren't. It's the leadership of Farm Bureau, which is in the valley. Any concerns that we've heard in the testimony today and last the other day, every one of those concerns has to be addressed. And they all go back to the same place those concerns go under the process today is back to LCDC. They make the final decision.
Mr. Chair, briefly, if I may. And I love agriculture, too. I'm a huge supporter of it. I'm one of the few Democrats in this building that enjoys a broad spectrum of support from the agricultural community because I support farmers and ranchers. The good people that are concerned about agriculture in Oregon on this bill, I hope they come and join us in dragging water out of the Columbia so we can help the agricultural industry in this state. I'm fairly confident that will not be the case, but I encourage them to do so and create real jobs in Oregon. Thank you.
Hey, Shelley Weatherall, Steve McCoy, and Stephen Kefouri, please. Go ahead, please identify yourself for the record, and we are in a tight schedule.
Thank you. Co-Chairman Barker, Co-Chairman Krieger, and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak. My name's Shelley Weatherall. I'm a lifelong resident and farmer. I live in Umpqua, and that's in Douglas County. At this time, I raise sheep, wine grapes, and timber. I've had submitted some written testimony previously and appreciate if you take the time to read it. I listened to the audio of Monday's hearing and decided to show up here, out of my element a bit, and voice some of my concerns, briefly. Recently at the January Douglas County Planning Commission meeting, this bill was discussed and touted as an opportunity to relax resource zones and restrictions. If this is how the bill is viewed locally, I believe that this is how the bill will be carried through. It was stated that the State Farm Bureau was against this bill. Actually, the resolution to put that in the policy was brought by Douglas County Farm Bureau. Douglas County Farm Bureau is opposed to this kind of redefining. For those that keep repeating one size doesn't fit all, I do not understand the thinking that combining three counties makes for any better fit. I do not believe just because Douglas County abuts Josephine and Josephine County abuts Jackson County that the three counties can come up with new definitions that are more pertinent and better than what we already have in place. Things like Douglas County's climate and soils, rainfall, heat units, length of growing season, they all lend to different potentials and productivity and crops than our neighbors to the south. As has been said before, the bill is unnecessary.
There's an exceptions process. If you're incorrectly designated, your property's changed, can no longer be viably farmed, or adjacent lands have made changes that prevent the use of your land. There's also a means to place non-resource dwellings on EFU land if it is generally unsuitable for farm or forest use. And as others have stated, there was a means provided by the 2009 legislature for a relook. Lastly, I'm really disappointed that this body, some of whom hype fiscal responsibility and living within our means, they put forth a bill that reinvents the wheel and appropriates $600,000 for their pet project. This bill is of no benefit to agriculture or forest economy of the state. In Douglas County, there's already a flood of property for sale. And relaxing and allowing farmlands to be developed only adds more to that flood. I believe this bill is a geist to weaken the protection of already threatened resource lands, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, and appreciate your briefness.
Any questions?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon, here to talk about the Dash 4s. This last-minute gutting stuff that did not have stakeholder input. So from what I can glean from what is in the Dash 4s is it is much like the previous versions. You enter into an IGA, which you can already do under ORS 19030 through 19130. You petition LCDC to redefine farm and forest land, which can already be done under ORS 183390 and ORS 197040. There's a twist on that, though. And then you remap, which you can do under HB 2229, which is codified under ORS 215, 788 through 794. So what's the twist? The twist is that in section 32DB, 32DD, and 32DE, there are criteria that open up instead of defining agricultural land based upon soil and growing conditions, it's based upon other things, location to the UGB, for example, looking into the crystal ball of long-term viability, those sorts of things. That's where our concerns will lie, in addition to the large appropriation. And also something that was discussed very briefly last time around was the Bear Creek Valley regional problem solving that is going on right now. It is drawing to a close. It's almost done. It looks like all parties are comfortable with what has taken place there. Parties that would not normally have gotten together have gotten together. And if this takes place in Jackson County, then that is going to blow up that process, which would be, frankly, a shame, especially all the state money that has gone to that. And also, we haven't heard from the counties here, so I think that would be useful. We haven't heard from the counties that they even want this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. These are land use planners, county planning officials, land use lawyers, and some private practice land use planners. Although we come from very disparate backgrounds in terms of our philosophies and our businesses, we do have one thing in common in the association, and that is that we're very supportive of Oregon's land use planning laws. Mr. Chair, I first came to land use planning in 1973 when I served on the committee that passed Senate Bill 100. And I've watched over the years what's happened to the process, and what's happened is every year more and more bills come in. I remember a couple of years ago there were 80 to 90 bills, each one dinging a little bit at the system. And when it's been brought to a vote of the people, the vote of the people support this very hard. 60% to 40% supports Oregon's land use planning system. But that means that 40% of the people out there don't like Oregon's land use system, and so we, in the legislature, deal with the result of some of the people from that 40% coming in here and saying, let's do something to diminish the land use standards that we have. And this bill is the latest iteration of that, in our view. We have some specific concerns. $600,000 is an interesting number. In the first place, my professional planners say it's not enough, the money that would be going to the counties. It won't be enough for them to do what the bill asks them to do. On the other hand, it is a sufficient amount of money if we had that money placed other places in land use plan given to LCDC for grants to local governments for them to do the work. Let me just read a small portion here from our statement that you have. The decrease in funds will be especially hard given the release of the 2010 census and corresponding needs for counties and cities to update population forecasts. These forecasts are needed to identify any additional lands for urban growth and development. The primary goal of Oregon's land use program is to plan for such growth within urban growth boundaries and to protect land suitable and capable for future resource use supports these local goals. Bottom line, Mr. Representative Schaffler is interested about economic development. That money that produces economic development is the land use planning that happens all over the state, and we're concerned if you have $600,000 extra to go into land use planning, that it should be used for grants around the state to help local governments do the kind of planning that they need to do so that they can grow. We essentially are opposed to the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions in this panel? Thank you, panel. I'm going to have one more person testify there. We've had people who testified previously on this and because of the time, but I am going to allow Paulette Alexandria because she came from over 100 miles.
I didn't come from over 100 miles. Maybe I checked the wrong
point. Yeah, you did. Okay.
You want to kick me out now? I'll give you the option because what I'm going to say you're not going to like.
Okay. You don't know that, so yeah, I won't have you testify then because you're already...
No. It's up to you, really. I mean, I'm not trying to be rude.
Oregonians who live in the valley don't count as much.
Have a seat.
Thank you.
Please be brief.
I will. Paulette Alexandria. I live in Marion County. I have a farm, but I did formerly live in Jackson Josephine County for 20 years, and I know quite a bit about the economy there. I am really kind of shocked and appalled by the willingness of many of you on this committee to subvert and hijack our land use laws. This is the first time I've been in the state capitol this week and in these proceedings, and I'm pretty amazed, and my eyes are open now to many things. But I am shocked by this because I think most people in Oregon do support our current land use laws. And if we really truly had local control, we wouldn't be here today, would we? We wouldn't even have a state capitol. So that argument falls on, I don't know, it doesn't make sense to me. Our land use laws are already amendable and transparent. And I don't see the reason to change them. The jobs that you would create by turning ag lands into strip malls and truck stops are not sustainable jobs. Those counties desperately need an employment base that's stable, where they have jobs that go on, not just construction jobs. That's what they need down there, and that's what we need to help them do, not change our land use jobs so they can go on selling subdivision after subdivision and taking our ag lands away. Like others said, we need to have our agricultural base shored up down there and have more farmers, profitable farmers, so our farmland can be used successfully. Based on this, I'd like to ask you to vote no on this, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. Yeah, other people who had signed up have already testified in the past. With the timeliness issue, we have several bills to go. We're going to go ahead and move on.
Mr. Co-Chair, before you move to a motion, since some of the other members of the committee weighed in about the repeat nature of this proposal or variations on it, I'd like to put on the record a slightly different take on that.
Please.
We have seen proposals like this in the past, under Republican gavels and Democratic gavels. And the body has heard this proposal several times and has, in its wisdom, as I said, under both Republican and Democratic leadership, rejected this proposal. So I think, actually, we are trying to change that under restrained time limits that are not the responsibility of anyone on this committee. So I think it's important to put on the record that under more normal times, when we've had plenty of opportunity for members of this body, the House and the Senate, but particularly the House, to look at this proposal, it's been rejected. So I think we need to make sure that that's on the record.
Thank you. Okay, we move from a public hearing to a work session on House Bill 4095.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 4095.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 4095. Is there any discussion? Is there any?
The only thing I'd like, if I may, Mr.
Sure.
Chair, I want to thank people who come from out of town. I think we see a lot of the same faces around here in so many meetings. When people come from a long ways away, leaving their work, I just want to say how much I appreciate you coming. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Is there any objection to the Dash 4 amendments? Hearing none. So
we don't have the fiscal, Mr. Chair, so I'd like to be able to suspend the rules for the purpose of moving the bill to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Krieger moves we suspend the rules so that we can move the bill to Ways and Means without the fiscal in hand. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Representative?
Me too. I object.
Okay.
Me too.
Representative Nolan and Representative Tomei object. Duly noted. I'll ask, take a roll, please. So we,
Mr. Chair, would you note my objection too? Just for the record,
we'll just do. Could we have a roll call, please, on this?
Representative Nolan,
this is on suspension of the rules. No.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
No.
Representative Wan.
Aye.
Representative Wisnett.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
No.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 4095 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 4095 be moved to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrett.
Just
please.
A brief comment. I'm going to be voting no on this motion, and I want to explain why. I don't actually agree with all of the criticism that's been offered of this proposal. In fact, last session I voted yes to continue the discussion of this in a different committee. I also am not afraid of more regionalism in our land use system. In fact, Representative Noller and I crafted House Bill 2229 in 2009, which moved us in that direction. I don't think that's a bad thing for the state, but I'm uncomfortable with how this has played out. We've been given essentially a brand new bill the morning of the hearing. It's been represented, and it may be true, that it's substantially the same and differs only in the appropriation. I saw from Mr. Honeycutt the marked up version of the original bill that was handed to council, and there was more change language on there than language that would stay the same. I haven't had a chance to compare the draft that we received with that markup, and my concern is that if we're not going to exercise the function to vet that language and make sure it's been done correctly, no one else is going to, because this is going to go to Ways and Means. It's in all likelihood going to bypass the Senate Policy Committee. I'm just not comfortable with rushing this through in such a compressed timeline. So I'll reluctantly be voting no on the bill, or no on the motion this morning.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shoffler.
With all due respect to my good friend, you know, we'll talk about rushing things through. I'm sorry. There's nothing in here that says anybody's going to develop anything. But it says it's going to help local communities decide when and if and where they're going to develop something. That's what we're doing here. And with LCDC completely involved. And we talk about the timeline. You know, I don't think there's a person in this building come tell me what health care and education reforms are going to definitely do. But, and there's billions and hundreds of billions of dollars riding on it. I challenge anyone to come and tell me exactly what those reforms are going to do. I don't think there's anybody that can do it, because we don't know. So if we're not in a hurry, if we're worried about being in a hurry about something as simple and productive and beneficial as this, then I suggest we definitely withhold any votes on those reforms as well, because they're far more substantial than this. This is a drop in the bucket compared to that. So if we're going to use that logic on this, we need to use that same logic on that, in my humble opinion.
Mr. Chair, I would only respond that, in part, I agree. It's not ideal to be moving those major reforms through a short session either, but at least those have been worked through a significant process involving, I think, every imaginable stakeholder group since the conclusion of last session. That has not happened here.
Yeah, I beg to differ. Thank you.
Representative Vaughn.
Well, I don't want to cut in front of Representative Tomei.
Go ahead, Jill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So
she's patient.
I appreciate that. I've listened to the concerns. I don't share any direct animosity towards folks in the Willamette Valley. That's where I'm from. I grew up in Troutdale. And but there is, we do have a flaw there that I will admit, and that is that we, at times, do not concern ourselves enough with what the rights of the minority is in our state. And I see that time and again. And it kind of reminds me when I walk into a room and see my older son holding my younger son's hand and hitting himself in the face and saying, why are you beating yourself up? And I look at that and I think, well, sometimes in the Willamette Valley we impose difficulties on rural Oregon, and then we wonder why rural Oregon struggles. You know, this system of land use has been in place in good economic times and bad. It has been in place for at least the last 25 years when we've seen some of the greatest economic growth in the history of the nation, and yet, at the same time, rural Oregon had unemployment rates in the double digits. So if this land use system is proper and allows rural Oregon to thrive, it would have thrived during those economic times, and they couldn't. So I think that this is a first step for legislators in the metro area to begin to show that we are listening and that folks in rural Oregon can be successful and can do so if we take off some of the shackles and let them have more control over their own destiny. So I'm voting yes.
Thank you. Representative Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, as I look through all of my materials that we've gotten during these hearings, and I've written notes about the people who testified, if we're here to represent the people, what I'm hearing from the people, especially the people who live in these areas that we're talking about, there's, and including my constituents, they're urging us to vote no on this bill. So I'm not sure who are we listening to if we're voting yes on this bill. So I will be a no.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to weigh in. I'm from Josephine County. But I'm going to say this. There's another dimension to this. There's an unrepresented voice to this that I want to speak up for, and that's, frankly, I'm 35 years old, and anybody who is my age or younger and opposes this bill really ought to think again, because my generation is looking at being a gap generation in terms of this economy. And farmers, I think you know what I'm talking about. The average age of a farmer in many communities is 70. What are your kids doing? Probably not what they'd prefer to do. Can they afford to buy a house? Chances are they can't. The dream of home ownership in America is at risk here, and it's got to do with supply and demand. The price of housing is too high. The jobs are too scarce. I mean, this is the kind of thing that we have to take a look at extremely carefully. Agreed. This has been vetted through three sessions. We have to do something. The state still has the final say in this bill, in this law. The overall scheme is not changing. People need a little bit of room. They need a little bit of hope. They need to get a job. They need to get a house. So, and yeah, there was one man, Jonathan. I get where he's coming from, and his friends that said that they can't find work. Life has changed. We need to change with it.
Thank you. And I've really been torn on this bill for a lot of reasons, and I'm going to support it today to move it on to so that a larger group could take a look at it. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shoffman?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Representative Wand?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Nix?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
No.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Next on the agenda, we'll go to House Bill 4095.
That was 4095.
I'm sorry, 4045. Open the public hearing.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 4045 comes to you from Representative Thatcher. You have the Dash 14 amendments in front of you, and they basically prohibits a public body from disclosing information that identifies a person as a current or former applicant of a concealed firearm permit unless the disclosure is made to another public body and is necessary for criminal justice purposes. Court enters an order in the criminal civil case directing the public body to disclose the applicant in writing consents to disclosure. Also exempts, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, from this provision, the judicial department, because they basically would have been in the position of checking the haystack to see how many needles were in it, in the sense that, unlike the sheriffs who have a keep track of these records, they could appear at court records, but it's not their primary purpose of the court records. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the other difference between the amendment and the original bill, as the law stands now, you have to check a box off that you don't want your information disclosed, and this would basically be, unless you want your information disclosed, it's not disclosed. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill is to address a Court of Appeals case that basically said this information is part of the public record and open to public disclosure.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I've just been handed the Dash 15 DC notice.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I frankly have not, no.
Would you like me to speak to that, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Okay, this amendment says that a public body may not disclose records or information relating to a concealed handgun license or application unless, A, the disclosure is limited to the name, age, and county of the residence of the license holder of the applicant. It's made to another public body. It's necessary for criminal justice. The court enters an order in a criminal civil case directing the public body to disclose the records or information or the license holder a consent to disclosure. So it's a pretty simple bill. As I said, would limit only the name, age, and county of residence of the holder of the license. And we have a member from Ledge Council here who want to discuss it.
Okay, thank you.
Josh Mills behind the desk.
One person signed up to speak on this, Paulette Alexandria.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
And identify yourself for the record.
Paulette Alexandria. I live in Marion County, formerly lived in the Rogue Valley. I wanted to speak on this one since I was going to be here anyway, and I've been associated with family members who are at work now who are NRA types. They belong to gun clubs. They have extensive training, and they believe in the Second Amendment. So I thought I'd represent them today to you all in that I would like you to vote yes on this bill, but not if they put a bunch of amendments in there that water it down. These people should have the right to privacy. They've been screened. Oh, well, I didn't give my thing to them. But on my testimony here, I have all the ways that Marion County screens people, and it's extensive. It's more than most of us have been screened.
and they have to know how to use their firearm. Sorry, here, thank you. So nobody else signed up. I came here to help support my family members who are those people, some of the finest people I've ever met in my life, employed, not criminals, sensible, level-headed, know what they're doing. And everyone that I've ever met that had a concealed weapons permit was at the same caliber, exemplar folks. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much
for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Ms. Alexandria for her testimony. I, too, grew up in rural America. I am a member of the NRA, and I am a gun owner and a supporter of the Second Amendment. And it's important in this building that we not burn bridges, because I'm grateful that we've found some common ground together today.
Thanks.
Any further discussion? Close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 4045.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash 14s and to House Bill 4045.
Representative Krieger would like to moves the dash 14s into House Bill 4045. Discussion. Okay, hearing none. Any objections?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Tomei objects.
We have 15 amendments. Can we just stand at ease for 2 minutes so I can kind of try and get my head around some of these?
Have the committee stand at ease?
Thank you. We have a restatement with the dash 14.
Give us a recap on
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash 14 amendments as it relates to the bill and current law, basically two things as it relates to the bill. And that is, the original draft would included within the definition of public bodies the courts. That meant the courts would have to have gone through all their records and redact any information that as it relates to concealed handgun permits. They do not keep records of concealed handgun permits, but it could come up in a court case. Okay?
That would mean, I think the expense to them, that when I talked to the court administrator's office, was well over $1 million. It was like checking not only for the needle in the haystack, but after you found the needle, making sure there aren't any other more needles in the haystack. The other part of the bill, what it does, currently now you check a box, whether you want your information not disclosed. Basically, this bill would say, the amendment would say, your information is not disclosed unless you say otherwise. So it flips that particular issue. And Representative Warren, if I remember correctly, you asked me if this went into the public records laws, and I don't believe that it does. So
yeah, and if I can comment on that. So I'm looking at the dash 14s, and it deletes from the original bill the phrase amending ORS 166.291.
That's right.
And then if you look through sections 1 and 2 in the amendment, it does not specify what sections of the Oregon Revised Statutes are being changed. So the way I read this, and Mr. Taylor, please, you have the experience, so tell me if I'm wrong, but the way I read this, it doesn't say where this will go, at which point legislative counsel is allowed in drafting our code to put it in the place where they think it belongs.
Mr. Nasby, please.
Good morning, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Representative Wan. You're absolutely right. One thing I would add, though, is when we place something in the code, we can't do so in a manner that changes the law that gives it legal effect. So I think one piece of information that might be helpful to you is 192.502 sub 9A incorporates other provisions of the law that make records confidential. So because this says thou shalt not disclose, that'll be picked up by the public records law and it will be exempt from disclosure.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Co-Chair. The reason why I'm wondering is I'm trying to think of the practitioner to make sure that they can find it properly and easily. And so that does that. So thank you.
Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Nasby, but that means that it does not pick up the definitions in 192, or does it?
That's correct. It does not, members of the committee. The bill does specifically pick up the definition of public body in that series and modifies it, but apart from that, the answer is no.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Nasby, can you point specifically to what part of the dash 14 addresses the issue of the needle in the haystack?
Yes, Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, Representative Nolan. The definition, so I'm looking at subsection 2 that says, as used in this section, public body has the meaning given that term in 192.410, which includes just about everybody. But if you keep reading there, it says, except it does not include the Judicial Department, so the Judicial Department is not subject to the prohibition on disclosure in the bill. So the public body shall not disclose does not apply to the Judicial Department.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Okay, we have a motion to move the dash 14s into House Bill 4045. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
Just better than the original, yes.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wan?
Aye.
Representative Wisnik?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. The amendments are adopted, dash 14.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion on another amendment, please. Colleagues, I'd like to move the dash 9s to this bill. Dash 9 is very simple. It was also before us last session. It changes the bill only in that it would put this issue within the context of the public records statute explicitly. Public records law is where we protect, for example, trade secrets, information about security weaknesses and security measures, social security numbers, and the home address and home phone numbers of public safety officers. Sensitive information is dealt with in the public records statute, and I have still never heard a persuasive reason why we should treat this issue differently from any other type of sensitive information. So I would suggest that for the sake of simplicity and to take advantage of the extensive case law that already exists on the public record statute, we go that route rather than create a completely new provision in state law. So I'd like to move the dash nines, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion? Representative, I'm sorry, Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have two people from Legislative Council's office here, the original drafter and Dave Hendricks, who also in the past has done public records laws. And I know your amendment, and it's to the public records laws, and it basically says it's only disclosable if a court finds a compelling interest to do so. What I'm not sure is whether we can adopt both amendments at the same time. They may be contradictory to each other. And I'm
certain they would be.
So I'm
trying to drum up business.
So I'm not sure what to say,
Mr. Zermatt.
Mr. Clark, I have a point of inquiry here, because when I look at the dash nines, it first says on page one of the printed bill, line three, delete 166-291, and then it continues. And then in line three of the dash nines, it says deletes lines 5 through 9 and pages 2 through 10 and insert the following. But since we adopted the dash 14s, there are no pages. Well, there's a page 2, but there's no pages 3 through 10.
They're still in the bill.
So then if we adopt the dash 9s, we would have both the 14s and the 9. So we have an additional section in two places in the public records law in addition to the new section here, because this is never deleted in the dash 9 amendments.
Mr. Chair, if the will of the committee is to adopt the dash 9, I think it would be a simple matter to get a new amendment drafted that reconciles the apparent conflict. But I have a feeling I know how that amendment's going to fare if we vote on it. So maybe we should just gauge the will of the committee.
Okay. We have a motion before us to move the dash 9s in. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Shockley?
No.
Representative Tomei?
Yes.
Representative Wand?
No.
Representative Wisnett?
No.
Vice Chair Hicks?
No.
Vice Chair Garrett?
Yes.
Co-Chair Krieger?
No.
Co-Chair Barker?
No. Motion fails.
Solve that problem.
Legislative Council fences.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 4045 to the floor to do pass as amended.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 4045 with the dash 14s to the floor to do pass. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, only to say, if I may, I think what our colleague suggested, something like that may have been worked out. But once again, something so simple, going so fast.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the assistance of Legislative Council on the issue that I was concerned with the practitioners, and I'm convinced the reason why I voted no on the dash 9s, I'm convinced that the dash 14s will be sufficient for practitioners to know where to look, and that was my key concern, was making sure that nobody gets surprised and everybody knows what the rules are. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair,
yes,
I really appreciate the attention that my good colleague from Troutdale and Multnomah County has given to this. But I'm not just concerned about practitioners being able to find things in the law. I'm concerned about whether regular citizens who don't pay as much attention as we do and don't have anywhere near the notice that we've all bemoaned how poor it is that we get, regular old folks being able to find their way through the ORS and knowing what their rights are and aren't, and we're making it harder on them.
Thank you. Any more discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shockley?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Representative Wand?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
No.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Krieger, you want to question?
Thatcher.
Representative Thatcher will be the carrier. Next Next item on the agenda, we'll jump down to House Bill 4025, open the work session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4025 comes to you from the Interim House Judiciary Committee. It has three parts, lowest from $60 to $45. State of Oregon's share of the fine amounts from traffic fines. If the fine amount is less than $45, the state receives the fine amount. Clarifies that the state of Oregon does not receive any money from snow park parking or helmet law violations. Places the county or city's portion of the fine imposed in the Justice of the Peace Court or Municipal Court on the same level as the state's proportion. Chair, members of the committee, we've adopted the Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments. Talking to Dave Hendricks after our last meeting, he has solidified those in the Dash 4, but made some tweaks to the bill that were technical in nature. I ask him to come up and explain to it. What we will have to do is recede from the Dash 1 and Dash 3 and then consider adopting the Dash 4. He will explain what they did.
But the I know if I had Dash 2 and 3.
Okay, 2 and 3.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Please, Mr. Hendricks.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council's office. There were just two little tweaks to the Dash 3 amendments which you had adopted. Those were the TriMet amendments that I discussed before the committee. One thing that I know that I had talked to TriMet about but had slipped back into those amendments was that they had hoped to have those rules that were laid out there about distribution of the monies applied to all courts. And as the draft of the Dash 3's amendments referred to circuit court, so the only change there was to delete the reference to circuit and simply say that in any court in which one of these citations were deposited, these rules of distribution would apply. So that was one. The other one was, at one point, the proposed amendments would have limited these rules to citations that were issued by the TriMet police peace officers, and many of these, some of these may be issued by other officers like Portland Police. So I removed some language that had appeared that had indicated that the distribution would be made to the district that employed the peace officer, to simply say the district that had enacted the ordinance, so it would cover whatever peace officer was issuing the citation. Those were the only two changes in the Dash 3s. The Dash 1s were not changed.
So, but we need to withdraw the ones, the twos and threes.
The Dash 4 incorporates both the Dash 1s and the Dash 3s with a few modifications of the Dash 3s. So if you adopt the Dash 4s, you're where you need to be. The Dash 2s were an earlier version of Dash 3 and are no longer significant.
So that we just need to adopt the Dash 4s. We don't need to undo any of the ones and 3s.
I believe you adopted the Dash 1s and the Dash 3s, so I do believe you need to recede from those two.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee rescind the Dash 1s and 3s that we passed previously and removed into the bill.
Representative Krieger moves we remove the Dash 1 and Dash 3 amendments. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I move that the Dash 4 amendments be put into House Bill 4025.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 4s into 4025. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 4025 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 4025 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wan?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries to the Ways and Means. Next, I'm going to open a hearing on the mentally ill, House Bill 4022. We have a lot of people I know came down and were, again, short on time.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4022 comes in from Mike Shrunk, District Attorney from Multnomah County, allows a district attorney or assistant district attorney to initiate civil commitment proceedings, includes within the definition of mentally ill person for the purposes of civil commitment, a person who is addicted to heroin, has two or more convictions within the past 5 years possession of heroin. The community mental health director receives a notice that the person was in possession of heroin within 30 days of a civil commitment proceedings, has no pending criminal charges, and five for whom it was would be difficult, if not impossible, to avoid another unlawful possession of heroin offense. Chair, members of the committee, the bill does things more than that, but it would take me a while to go through it. I think you probably want to hear from the witnesses.
Okay, thank you. I call Ryan Lufkin, Mr. McDonnell, and Linda O'Malia. O'Malia, I'm saying probably sitting there wrong. Please go ahead, anybody. Just identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonnell. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I've been a prosecutor for 32 years. The last 15 years, I've led the drug unit in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. Portland, as best as we can determine, has a dubious distinction of having the highest heroin overdose rate of any large city in America. In the last 6 years, we have partnered with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Portland to aggressively prosecute overdose cases, trying to lead from the death up the chain of distribution to those who are responsible for bringing heroin into our community. We have been fairly successful in doing that. I think we're probably a model for other cities in the country. We have been able to successfully prosecute major drug trafficking organizations that are bringing in kilos of heroin into Portland. But despite that, we continue to see the number of overdose deaths increase in Portland and in Oregon. I initially started that process. More recently, Mr. Lufkin, who's a deputy that works under my supervision, has taken over that role. He has worked closely with the families of these deaths. He's gotten to know them personally, has become very committed in that process. He has compiled a notebook with the photographs of people who have died of heroin overdose deaths. He uses that in negotiating cases with defendants, offenders, trying to urge them into treatment, at sentencing with judges. And being as committed as he is to trying to find a solution, something better than the current system, he has come up with this particular proposal. Unfortunately, it appears, the evidence suggests, that the problem is likely to get much worse before it gets better. Last year, we had 52 overdose deaths in Portland. While the official statistics won't be released until the spring by the State Medical Examiner's Office, it looks like we'll have somewhere between 70 and 100. Last year, the Multnomah County 911 emergency system had 2,200 calls for non-fatal or fatal overdoses. Those almost entirely were heroin. The cost to the system is tremendous. Simply calling out an ambulance costs over $900. A visit to the emergency room is $500. So in Multnomah County alone, just responding to those overdose costs is in the millions. Gresham last year administered Narcan, the drug that brings overdose people back from the dead, 151 times. So without that process, the situation would be much worse. What's most disturbing is that the number of young people that we see addicted to heroin, we've told by health officials, law enforcement, that a disproportionate number of the heroin addicts that they see are people in their teens and early 20s. Evidence suggests that this is tied to abuse of opioid pain medications, which is consistent with national studies conducted by the Substance Abuse Mental Health Administration, which ranked Oregon number one in the nation in the illicit abuse of opioid pain medications of people 18 to 25. This bill is an attempt to come up with a different solution to deal with that problem. It is modest. It attempts to be conservative, to try a new solution to address this problem. Hopefully, it will be accepted in that way. Oregon has been a leader in trying to address the problem of substance abuse. Multnomah County had the second drug court in the nation that has now become a national model. Oregon has led the way in the methamphetamine epidemic with the passage of the law with pseudoephedrine. Since that law has passed, clandestine methamphetamine labs have virtually disappeared in Oregon, and I congratulate you for your work on that. I would like now to turn it over to Mr. Lufkin. I would note for the committee that there are several parents here in the hearing today who have had children, loved ones, die of a heroin overdose death.
Please. Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I come before you today to tell you that
you need to identify yourself.
Excuse me, Ryan Lufkin. I'm a Multnomah County District Attorney. I come before you today to tell you that what we have in the current Oregon revised statutes, we've used, and we are out of options to try and combat this problem from the from that end. The Oregon sentencing guidelines that have been adopted provide very little incentive for someone who is repeatedly using heroin to ever engage in treatment. There is some incentive for a first-time heroin user to enter into our drug court to avoid a felony conviction, but this bill addresses those folks who have been convicted multiple times. And there is essentially little to no incentive for any of those folks to engage in drug treatment. They will have spent the 10 days that is prescribed by law in custody well before we ever reach a trial date. It is without question that these folks will be using heroin for months, several times a day, while we are waiting to try and get a trial scheduled. In Multnomah County, once we obtain a conviction, there is very little supervision for these people on probation. There's very little resources to supervise them, and there is very little treatment available to them. We are compounding one problem upon another. As Mr. McDonald said, there are over 2,000 911 calls each year for this offense. That is costing our county millions and millions of dollars, let alone the tragic loss in life that I hear about every single day. These folks that are using heroin and are dying are getting younger and younger every single year. You don't have to take our word for it. You should have letters from both a treatment provider in Portland, Treatment Services Northwest, the director of that program in support of this bill, and from Judge Marshall, who ran the drug court program for over 5 years in support of this bill. Everyone is struggling to find some solution to prevent these young Oregonians from dying on our streets every night. And this is, I believe, the best way to accomplish that goal. Heroin users need treatment, they need it fast. And the civil commitment process, if amended to allow for heroin addicts to go through it, is a process that works very quickly to bring people to treatment. I want to make it very clear that no one intends for any of these folks to go to the state hospital, and no one intends for this at all to be a punitive measure. The goal here is to direct these people to outpatient and residential programs that are not locked facilities. These are treatment facilities. These are the same exact facilities that these people are put into when they go on probation. It just gets them there faster and directly from jail. In this book that I have, nearly 25% of the folks died within 10 days of being released from jail. That's because they've sobered up a little bit. And when they go out of custody and use the same amount of heroin that they used before going into custody, they die. And there is no way to get them from jail to a treatment facility other than through a court's order. If they're released from jail currently, the most likely time that they will be released in the middle of downtown Portland is 10 or 11 o'clock at night. This is an unacceptable situation. It's unacceptable to the parents. And I urge you all to consider supporting this measure in whatever way you can. And I think we're all intent on working on any possible problems that anyone raises to create a system that works. The only other thing I'd like to address is the scope of this proposal. We are interested in a pilot program. We want to see if this works. We sure believe it will. And the reason there's a two or more prior conviction prerequisite is that limits the number of people to approximately 16. So this is a very small program in scope. We would expect 16 people to actually fit within it in 1 year. That should give us an understanding of whether or not we can save the system money with those 16 people who are otherwise costing tens of thousands of dollars in incarceration costs alone, and whether we can provide them better access to treatment. We expect that this bill, through reduced costs from Senate Bill 1145, which pays $93 a day to the county to incarcerate these folks for an average of 4.2 months per offense, each time they fail their probation. We expect that those savings would go a long way to paying for this bill. I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Linda O'Malia. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I have a doctorate in public administration and policy. I have been a mental health examiner in civil commitment hearings in Oregon for over 30 years. Currently, I work in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas County routinely on a scheduled basis, and I do some outlying counties, Clatsop, Columbia, and Yamhill, infrequently. There's not much action. And actually, in Multnomah County, that is the center of commitment hearings for the state. 40% of all the hearings are done in Multnomah County, and they have court scheduled every day of the week, so they schedule a team of examiners every single day. There's a lot of action there, and they can handle from 1 to 5 hearings a day, sometimes 7, but it's usually more like 1 or 2. It's really set up to handle commitment hearings. Commitment hearings are somewhat unique. They may be held in the courtroom, or they may be held in the hospital, in a conference room or actually in the patient's room. There are 1 or 2 examiners, a public defender, and county counsel, as well as a judge. There may be witnesses, but there's always an examination of the person or patient in question. The proceedings are not litigious. They're very polite, very quiet. They're focused on determining the most reasonable course of action as dictated by current statutes. Sometimes the examiners will recommend a course of action that the judge cannot endorse because the law doesn't follow that way. The process attempts to be supportive of the person needing help, and the judges are very attentive to the needs of the allegedly mentally ill person. They're given many opportunities to express themselves and be heard. Currently, the commitment statute for the mentally ill is 6 months, and for the mentally retarded, developmentally delayed with a mental health diagnosis is 1 year. If committed, the person is assigned to the state mental health services with specific placement to be determined by the mental health caseworker or investigator who has followed the case. Then a commitment monitor will follow the case, determine when the committed person is ready to be transitioned to a lesser level of care or actually discharged from the commitment.
Can I ask you to summarize, please, since
yes.
we have a lot of witnesses in
the Yes, okay.
Thank you.
And given the nature of addiction, remaining in a structured environment is very important. And I referenced some research that indicated that treatment has to be at least 3 months and longer to affect a major behavioral change. And when it has been, residential treatment has been used for 6 months or more, there was a significant drop in heroin use on a national study from 17% to 5.8%. So we have the process in place, and the research would endorse a longer continuous level of treatment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If anybody has a brief question for this panel.
Just briefly, Mr. Chair. When I was in Union, I was a hod carrier for a year, and I had an old pal named Gary Quint. And I don't know if any of you know what a hod carrier is, a bricklayer, and it takes incredible physical and mental stamina to do that job for any amount of time. I know I did it. Gary was a heroin addict, and he was one of the smartest workers I've ever worked with. He just could not get off heroin. He tried several years ago. On Christmas morning, they found him slumped over his steering wheel dead of a heroin overdose in downtown Portland. Mm-hmm. I think this touches everybody. I'll be quite frank with you, I don't think we have the money, but I think methamphetamine should be added onto this too.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Mr. Chairman of the committee, Mr. McDonald, you talked briefly before this hearing. But my reading of the bill is it goes beyond just the issue of opiates. It also goes to some of the basic structures of our civil commitment process. For example, currently it's the director of the state hospital that makes a determination to release people back into the community, I assume when they find that they're no longer a danger to self or others. And when I read in the bill, we would take that authority from the director of the state hospital and give that authority to the county mental health director. Is that correct?
Can I let Mr. Lefkin address that?
There were a number of changes that legislative council included to try to address the situation, the difference between sending someone to the state hospital and sending someone to a community care. And I think there may be issues that need to be addressed that specifically divide out the authorities between sending someone to the state hospital and sending someone to a community treatment facility, because they are different consequences. And I think there needs to probably be some work along those lines.
Well, as I understand 426 from a non-lawyer's point, the commitment currently is to the Division of Mental Health, or its current title, not to the hospital, and it's determined where the people go. And most times they do not go to the state hospital. They go to a community hospital that they've just been in. There are two campuses of the state hospital that people may go to, but that's down the line a little way. So
thank you, panel. Appreciate your time and testimony. I'm going to call up, I have four more people. I'm going to call them up in two since there's only three chairs there. Mr. Densom and Ms. Whips, please. And I don't want to cut anybody short, but we are really pressed for time. We have one more bill we need to address. We have five more people to testify.
Thank you. My name is John Densom. I'm here with my wife, Shirley, in the audience. We're from Troutdale, Oregon. We're here to testify today in favor of 4022. The reason we're here is because 8 months ago, we lost our son. Day before yesterday, we were in a sentencing hearing where we put away a drug dealer with the help of Ryan Lifkin and a lot of officials from Troutdale and Portland and Multnomah County. So we're very happy about that. This is step one in a process that I made a promise when my son died. If I might, I would like to pass around a picture.
If you just hand the staff there, hand it around. Thank you very much.
I was only introduced to this House bill day before yesterday, so I really haven't had time to totally read through it. I've done a summary. Does it go far enough? I don't think so. But I think this is a really good first step, and I think we really need to take a look at it. This would not have helped my son. My son was never in trouble with the law. We put him through rehab on two separate occasions over a period of about a year and a half. It is a very expensive proposition, somewhere close to $18,000 uninsured expense from our pockets to put him through this. Unfortunately, a week after he successfully graduated from the rehab facility, he relapsed, overdosed, and died. Interesting part about this bill is that it doesn't force people who go into this program to accept a criminal conviction. Had a situation where I work. I'm an engineer in a high-rise in Portland. I happen to have the Attorney General's office in my building, we hired a contractor to come in and do basic janitorial work. The guy was an excellent worker. We were so pleased with him. Department of Justice came back to us, said that he couldn't work there because he had a previous conviction, a felony. It turned out that what had happened was he was an addict 13 years ago. He pled to a greater degree of the law. In other words, a felony. He pled to a felony because it got him into a rehabilitation program. So unfortunately, we had to let him go. So the fact this bill keeps people from having to be criminalized to go through treatment is a good thing. The other thing that I wanted to address is that this is not just a problem in Multnomah County or big urban areas. I live in Representative Wan's district. Good to see you again. So I'm right at the edge of, you know, what you'd consider maybe a little bit rural. But when my son was in rehab, we were down every weekend. We got to go down. We had family counseling. We got to meet the other parents. There were maybe 15, mostly young people in the rehab. But they were from places like Medford, Bend, Pendleton, not just Portland. Maybe half of them were from Portland, but the other half were from more rural areas. Sometimes you see the crime statistics that come through being based in, you know, urban Multnomah County and so forth. The availability of drugs in that county will attract people to come there and commit their crimes, and so that probably skews the evidence of statistics. As far as the addiction goes, I try to make a comparison to, so you can understand possibly how I feel that the addiction might be. If you could imagine yourself swimming maybe 10, 15 feet underwater, and you suddenly realize that you're out of breath. Well, you're scrambling to get to the top. You got to get to the top. You get to the top, you take in a big, deep breath. Okay, you're saved. The difference between heroin addiction and your addiction to oxygen is that your addiction to oxygen is going to save you. The heroin's going to kill you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for your testimony. And we're sorry for your loss. And I really appreciate you being able to come down and testify before us. It truly makes a difference. And thank you again.
Thank you.
Please.
Hi, my name is Penny Whips, and I'm from Sisters, Oregon. I got in my car at 4:30 this morning in order to drive over and testify in front of all of you to ask you to put a face to these nameless victims. My son, Kyle, died 23 days of his short of his 22nd birthday on September 6, 2008. And in April of 2010, I founded a nonprofit called Just One Time that I travel across the country now speaking to high school students about good kids living dangerously and really challenging students to break the code of silence on behalf of their friends who are living dangerously. And I think it's really hard, unless you are in our shoes, to understand the loss that a child exiting in the way of that, a heroin overdose or any kind of death, creates for the family. Kyle was a kid that if you lined up a bunch of students, you would not have picked him out of the crowd to be someone who would succumb to a heroin overdose. He would not have been one of those kids. He was highly functional part of our community, an athlete, a musician, and had a great couple of colleges going after him. So the reason why I'm here today, Kyle would have not benefited from this bill, but the gentleman or the man who sold him the heroin would have. He was a repeat offender numerous times, and he would benefit from this bill. I think that will it save everyone? No, but it will save some. And that is why I do what I do, in order to give students an avenue where they're thinking differently about behavior and consequences, and friends willing to stand up. And I think with this bill, it's an avenue. It could be a solution to saving some of these young kids that are dying of heroin overdoses. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And you're right. I don't think anybody who has not lost a child, and I have not, can understand what you went through.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you coming down. Rebecca Peterson and David Michael, please. Okay. Is Ms. Peterson and Mr. Michael here? Okay, they're in overflow. Mr. Judep, why don't you and Mr. Straub and Boutsos come up, please, and go ahead. We'll call you up in just a minute. I'm sorry. Go ahead, because we were short of time. I'll keep things moving, please. The bill's not going to move today, so we'll just have a hearing. Okay, thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Alex Bassos. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm the training director for the Metropolitan Public Defender. I also wrote a book for the Oregon State Bar on civil commitments and a book for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association on mental health and criminal defense. I've handled hundreds of civil commitments and thousands of criminal cases. I know and respect both of the Multnomah County DAs that were here today, as well as Dr. O'Malley, who I've worked with many, many times. And I agree with much of what they say, including the fact that heroin overdose is a real problem in our community, and the legislature should probably take some steps to address that. But this bill is a misguided attempt to address that problem. What it does is essentially create a mini criminal justice system within the commitment system. For reasons that Mr. Lufkin and Mr. McDonald set forward, the criminal justice system, the processes, the burdens the Constitution places on the criminal justice system means that the criminal justice system takes too long for their purposes, and so they want to use the commitment system. The commitment system is used when someone is dangerous to themselves. And interestingly, the commitment system could be used in cases of heroin overdose or people who are at high risk of heroin overdose as it now stands. But what this bill does is create essentially a new repeat offender law within the commitment system, so that if a person is on their third heroin possession case, the district attorney could, instead of charging that person criminally, they can charge the person through the commitment system. the person would be held in jail, not a hospital. There would be no assessment of whether this person was actually dangerous to themselves, only that this is their third possession. They would be forced into treatment, but then they wouldn't be supervised by the Oregon Health Authority or anybody associated with that. That power is transferred to the court, and the DA is kept in the loop the whole time, so that if the person doesn't do what they're supposed to be doing in treatment, they come back to court, they can be put in jail again, and again put in treatment. Right? This sounds a lot like a criminal probation. In fact, I mean, to my eyes, it pretty much is a criminal probation, and the only difference is we're calling it a commitment. And the most important thing is that we're skipping over the protections that the commitment system places, that there is an individual assessment that this person is dangerous to themselves. So let me just assert one more time that I think that the most obvious solution to this that hasn't been tried is using the commitment system as it now stands. There are cases, appellate cases on point, that say specifically that addiction is a mental disorder that qualifies under the commitment system. If the person doesn't have control of themselves and is a danger to themselves as a result, that person can be committed. This is exactly what we're talking about with the heroin overdose problem. According to what Mr. Lufkin told me on the phone the other day, the average heroin addict overdoses 20 or 30 times a year. It's part of the addiction, as I understand it from Mr. Lufkin. But that creates all the evidence you need, really, for a commitment, assuming that this is a person who really has overdosed recently and is in great risk of overdosing in the near future. That is what the commitment system is for, and the only thing it's lacking are the treatment beds, right? The treatment beds that the district attorneys can't find necessarily through the criminal justice system or the probation department. But that's a separate problem. That doesn't require creating a whole new hybrid criminal justice commitment thing that skips over the protections of both systems. That requires funding for treatment beds, which we all know we need. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as member of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the director of Disability Rights Oregon. In the course of my 25-plus years in that position, I've worked on the civil commitment statutes, and so I'm very familiar with them. I actually asked Mr. Passos to go first because I knew that I would agree with what he said, and I do. My concerns are not about the prospect of using commitment for the purpose of warding off imminent death or harm to people who have addictions. It's the manner in which this bill would go forth and do that. It really needs more work. And very briefly, civil commitment is something that came out of our desire to deal with communicable diseases. It's a public health measure in which the government steps in because of imminent harm to the public or to an individual. It's very clear that that's going to happen. And it started out with, you remember Typhoid Mary and those stories from many, many years ago, and it's been extended to civil commitment over the years. Here we have what is a quasi-criminal proceeding, which bases a commitment decision upon criminal behavior. It's very different, and trying to graft it into our civil commitment laws, I feel, is inappropriate. It could have some very poor unintended consequences, such as the ones that errors that the drafters apparently made when they were looking at the commitment process in the bill. So for that reason, I would ask that we do some more thinking about this.
Okay, thank you. And just my personal experience with civil commitment as a police officer, it's very difficult, as it should be, to get somebody to stick somebody away like that without a lot of judicial thing. We will be working more on this bill and expect to see it come back next session. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, if we could go back, I'm sorry, Mr. Michael and Ms. Peterson, please. And again, as you can see, we're losing some members of the committee. We're over time now, and I don't want to cut you short at all. If you just would keep that in mind, please.
My name is Rebecca Peterson. I'm from Josephine County. I'm also a criminal defense attorney. I've been one for 14 years. Most of my court-appointed clients are addicts of some sort, although our area is mostly infested with methamphetamine. We do also have heroin. I take those individual civil liberties very seriously and do my best to protect them. I also do child protective services work, and I'd say the percentage of addicts among the parents that I deal with are even higher. It's enormous, and it's just devastating to those families and to our community. I also do juvenile delinquency work, and often see the same children that I saw in the Child Protective Services coming into the system, and the children of defendants that I've represented. So I definitely see both sides of this and respect the objections that were made, but I am in favor of this. I would have been in favor of it anyway, but I'm here today because my 21-year-old son, Christopher, died of a heroin overdose in Portland on St. Patrick's Day 2010. So I've experienced the devastation of that as well as seen it. I think this is an excellent idea. I don't know if it's going to have to be tweaked, but I think the core of it is excellent because it's analogous. I also defend individuals in civil commitment, so I see that part of it, and it's, to me, very much the same thing. One of the reasons, I heard a little bit of the history of the civil commitment process, but one of the reasons we still have it and use it the way we do for mentally ill people is because we are willing to impose on their adult rights and their civil liberties out of humanity, because we realize that they can't help themselves, they can't recognize the danger they're in, they can't assess the reality, and they can't do what they need to help themselves. So we impose on them to make a bridge from where they are to where they can help themselves. Heroin addiction is so overwhelming. It's so quickly addictive. It's so powerful that person in an entrenched heroin addiction is very much like a mentally ill person in that they cannot help themselves. They cannot break free on their own, and it is incredibly difficult for them to voluntarily step into the incredible pain and sickness that they know is coming through the withdrawal process. It's very, very difficult for an impaired person to say, I am going to go through hell now to help myself. And in that way, they're very much in the same position, in my opinion, as a mentally ill person, and also need that bridge. My son was a member of a record year of heroin overdoses, and it's continuing. Let me make it clear, this bill would not have helped my son. He was never arrested. I found out my son was using heroin when the officers came to my office to tell me that he was dead of it. That was my first notice. So this would not have helped him, but it could have if he had been luckier. And it can help other people. And every addict is somebody's son or daughter, and they were meant for better things, and they need help to get there, and they can't help themselves.
Thank you very much. Sorry for your loss, please.
Hi, my name is David Michael. My son Brian Michael died September 16th of this past year from a heroin overdose in Troutdale, Oregon, alone in his Jeep in a Burger King parking lot. I can't describe the pain of losing a son. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. What I do know is that the problem with heroin in Oregon presently is astronomical. Now, I can speak with some knowledge about this because myself, I'm a recovering heroin addict myself, and I've been clean and sober for over 20 years. So I know specifically how difficult it is. Now, I would have to say that I'm in favor of this bill for the future hopes of others. For my son's benefit, it wouldn't have helped him because fortunately we had health insurance and I had plenty of money in the bank to pay for his several stints in rehab. And I worked very closely with him on that. The big problem I have with a lot of this heroin that's coming into Oregon is simply, well, in my son's case, it was on Channel 2, Channel 6, Channel 12 news. And I spoke to them in public about it. And I asked them specifically, don't disclose where I live. Well, they did disclose where I live. Now, there's known gang members in this group of five illegal aliens of this ring that they busted up around Troutdale. So that puts me and my immediate family in significant danger presently. Now, I happen to be a member of the NRA, so I can certainly protect my family, and I will if I need to. Hopefully it never comes to that. Any responsible gun owner would say the same, I'm sure. That would be a last resort. I've got a lot of anger towards these people. Number one, because they're here illegally. Number two, because they helped my son kill himself, basically. Now, as I understand it presently, I know in John's testimony, I don't know if he brought it up or not, but the fellow that they convicted the other day got 74 months. I ask you all here today, how many months sentence is your son or daughter's life worth? You know, now I'm not all for paying the tab for all these guys in prison either. But, you know, if people are in the legislature and they're making laws and all that, you know, I'd suggest that, you know, when you go to sleep at night, perhaps ask yourself, what have I done today to help others, you know? I don't know. You know, nothing's going to bring them back. I know that, you know, and I'm not going to carry a lot of anger about the illegals because that just tears me down. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that, you know, for instance, I live right next door to a house full of illegal aliens in Mount Angel. I've called the local police saying they're dealing drugs. The gal on the other end of the line tells me, well, how do you know it's drugs they're dealing? So, you know, if it doesn't affect an individual personally, nobody wants to do anything. It's preposterous. And so I put myself in a position, so what do I do now? Do I call the sheriffs? Do I go to the state police? So, you know, I've got some decisions to make, you know. But the reality is that, you know, people like myself have paid a dear price to be a citizen and to have freedom in this country. I'm a Vietnam Marine Corps veteran, and I happen to be a disabled Marine Corps veteran. And it's like, you know, I hear all this about, well, we don't want to do racial profiling and all this. Well, you know, I can say one thing. If you drove down Lancaster Drive 30 years ago, and you drive down Lancaster Drive now, it's a completely different world. So have we become a nation without borders? Do the individual citizens have rights? I guess that's my question.
Okay, thank you. Again, I'm sorry for your loss, and I can see the suffering, and I can't imagine it, but I can certainly see that. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 4022. We have to jump back real quick to House Bill 4025, Wayne.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at House Bill 4025, you need to reconsider it because
although we had the fiscal impact statements and revenue impact statements for the 1 and 3s, we did not have it for the dash 4s, which are basically, for all practical purposes, a combination of 1 and 3s. So we need to reconsider the bill for the purposes of suspending the rules as it relates to having the fiscal and revenue impact statements. Then we can then, once again, send the bill to the committee.
Open a work session on House Bill 4025.
And move for unanimous consent to reconsider the motion and send 4025 to Ways and Means.
Representative Krieger moves for unanimous consent to suspend the rules. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so order.
Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 4025 as amended, and that we suspend the rules and send it to subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative moves under the suspension of rules 4025 to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, is that what you mean? Is 4025? That's what you keep saying.
4025 is the direct.
Yeah.
42. It's one about the fine.
We passed, right, yes.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Is there any objection? Okay, motion carries. Go ahead. We're out of time. We're really out of time. People have to be other places at 10:30. We have it on the scheduled bill, House Bill 4021. We're just going to have to roll that over.
I don't know.
Until tomorrow. And I apologize to everybody that's here for that. I'm sorry we just... That due with this.
Move
23. We've moved
that already.
23 moves.
Move.
I'm sorry, Mickey Strauss. I'm sorry, I missed you. Come on up, and I'll reopen House Bill 4022. A lot of people have to leave. So.
Chair, I apologize and thank you for the opportunity, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, Becky Strauss with the ACLU of Oregon, just wanted to chime in on House Bill 4022. We do appreciate the discussion and want to echo the comments of those others who have voiced concerns about the bill. Hope to be part of ongoing discussions about these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. And I tried to call your name, but I said it wrong. I see okay. I had you on the list. Thanks. I'm sure probably adjourned.
Oh, Lordy.